Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. You're listening to Missed Apex Podcast. It's a bonus episode to whet your appetite for the Bahrain Grand Prix. I'm Spanners, your host. I don't know things, not really, but I like to find people who do know things. And that's why I'm joined by a man who has been an F1 strategist for Mercedes, the guys at the top there, and also for Haas. So he has a full spectrum of the F1 grid. And he's currently lurking in Bahrain for reasons unknown. It's Mike Caulfield. Hello, Mike. Nice to meet you. And are we allowed to ask why you're there?
I'm just providing a bit of support out for a number of teams, a bit of consultancy.
Nice.
I'll keep it at that. I'll keep it a bit more secretive in that sense.
Keep it nice and vague. I like that. It is an absolute pleasure and an honour to talk to you because you have been in the belly of the beast, right on that pit wall where the action's happening. Can I try and frame where you were in the hierarchy of, say, Haas F1? There's Gene Haas, Gunter Steiner, the guy that goes box, 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 and then the strategist?
I'd say that. I mean, you kind of, the strategist is, it's a weird role, and this is the same for any team, that you, because you're not associated specifically with a car, you kind of, you're a floater, you try and work. You work with both cars equally. So really directly, you work for mainly the chief race engineer. So you're technically the same level as a race engineer in a sense, but everyone's different, isn't it? Race engineers have a lot of importance. Strategists have a lot of importance. It very much depends. I mean, you'll have some teams where the strategist reports directly to the team principal, but yeah, I wasn't quite at that stage. I took my...
orders,
that's the correct word, orders from the chief race engineer or director of engineering.
Okay, so I wasn't thinking about the strategist being basically an overall strategist, so there will be situations where you do the maths and the most points means sacrificing a driver's race. I bet you're not always popular.
No, I mean, definitely not. you always try to get the best result for the team. That's ultimately your job. And even if you have a team which is maybe five or six people and you start designating one of the just strategy engineers to each car, you still have to have some rules of engagement of such to kind of favour the ultimate gain is the most points for the team, and you have to favour the lead car to obviously in terms of strategic preference. So even if you've that second car and you're wanting to do something, if it potentially affects your first car, you can't do it. So in that situation, you sometimes lose out. And obviously drivers don't see this. The drivers want to do the best result for them. I mean, they want to do the best result for the team, but ultimately their main thing is to beat their teammate. And you almost put a block in that in some aspects. I mean, I've had a couple of slight, not disagreements, but slight unhappiness from drivers there, but they understand it in the end. They're like anyone. They're upset at the time, but they understand the general thing, and sometimes they have to maybe have a bit of a dressing down from the man above.
I'm just trying to think which driver pairings you must have had with you. Rosberg, Hamilton, I'm assuming. I bet that got frosty quickly.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, so when I was at Mercedes, I was obviously a little bit lower down the rung, so I was I wasn't in charge of the full...
You got to watch it without the responsibility. That's
well,
good.
No, there's still the responsibility there, but it's not the initial heat. So so there was a little bit of it, but it was still difficult because, yeah, you were still having to try and juggle it, and you were still making the decision around it. And I mean, it's sometimes harder, especially that last season in 2016, they were racing each other. They weren't racing anyone else. And that makes it even difficult because sometimes if there is someone else in between, you can justify decisions because you can say if you lose out, you're losing out to him, but you're beating him. Whereas in that 2016, it was a direct fight between the two of them. So it was, I think anyone you speak to over that, it was not a pleasant season,
I bet.
in a lot of sense.
Well, moving on to probably a slightly nicer atmosphere, it does seem like maybe Haas for you, a smaller shop, so you get to be a little bit further up the chain. And two of my favourite drivers, actually, I guess you'd have started with Grosjean and Magnussen, who's coming back. They both seem like a genuine talent and pleasant folk as well.
Yeah, Yeah, it was very different. I mean, like you said, like I made that step up to Haas, and that's like, so I went from just your race strategy engineer to the head of strategy. So you go through that, and it was their kind of first time dealing with it. But it was, like you say, it was a small team. At that point, they're in the midfield, and it was good. It was a good challenge. There was a lot of things which the team had to do. There's a lot of good people there. You just unfortunately don't have the resource of the additional 400, 500 people that other teams do. So you're just trying to do your much, and there's only so much you can do. But yeah, in terms of the drivers, but I mean, touching on Kev coming back I got on really well with Kev. I thought he was a fantastic guy. It's great to see him back. It was always a big disappointment when he left. I mean, people kind of think, I saw comments last week when I said, "Oh, there's no chance for youth." He's still only 29 years old.
Yeah.
He's not an old driver either. He's still got a lot to show, so he's good. And then, yeah, Roman as well. I mean, he's obviously a bit more experienced of the two, and I mean, he wears his hat on his sleeve. He's a very different personality to Kevin, but at the same time, he's a very talented driver. I mean, on his day, he is very, very quick, and he was good. And he just needed to be managed correctly and stuff. But again, really decent bloke. I mean, and I actually caught up with him a couple of weeks ago. I was in for IndyCar in St. Pete, so I managed to catch up with him there. And he generally seems very happy there. He's I think it's really suiting him that. And he's
that's good.
Yeah, and I think I'll be surprised if he doesn't get some wins this year in IndyCar. If at least that, and if not challenging for the championship in that, because I think he's got the talent.
It's nice to have that confirmed, because that was nice, one of the nicest sort of driver pairings, and also probably one of the genuine talented driver pairings as well.
Yeah.
And then to be replaced with two new rookies, it felt a little bit jarring. And then obviously they've taken steps down from there. I'm sure that's a coincidence. I'm not looking for gossip from you, Mike. I really want to talk tactics and strategy. Now, you're talking about the challenge of a lower team and the less resources. So obviously you're on the pit wall. During the race, you're on the pit wall, you've got your compass and you've got your slide rule. But I guess at Mercedes, do they have more information to draw upon than a team like Haas?
Information, a little bit. But, like, I mean, it's more resource. So, I mean, it's more the amount of people you've got doing, plugging the numbers, checking over things, looking at, like, covering all 20 cars, covering radio, covering video. That aspect of it. In terms of data, everyone gets the same lap times. Everyone generally gets the access to the GPS data. So you can cover that off. And just obviously with Haas, it was a case of quite a fresh team when I got there. So it was a case of building up my analysis tools, creating what I wanted to do, and trying to get you had to be efficient, basically, though. So you couldn't just cover all aspects of it. So you thought, right, what's the important things? What do we need to cover? When I first came in, it was literally just me in the group compared to, yeah, like you say, your Mercedes or Ferrari, your Red Bull, who might have four or five people in their strategy groups. Right.
So they didn't give you a budget and say, right, Mike, go on LinkedIn and find us 8 fantastic strategists.
Yeah, not us.
No.
Okay. The budget was for one person, not them.
So you're sat there on your own, and sometimes you look at races and you go, well, that's a simple, straightforward one stop. And recently, actually, there's been more one stops than in the period before it. So it can feel like that's straightforward for a strategist, but there's always like something that will come up that will change. Obviously, the competition safety cars have gotten a little bit more popular, competition red flags. How much flexibility in a standard one stop do you have to do things? Because sometimes it looks like it's set in stone.
So this is, it's very variant. So, I mean, and it differs throughout the field. So I'll go for it. Like, you got your Mercedes or Red Bull, say, for in a one-stop, and they have some flexibility because they are that fast that they're able to create this gap to the cars ahead. Mm. So they can do this one-stop, and they can make this first pit stop, drop into free air, and they literally pit from first and go into third, maybe, or fourth, and behind the teammate and the person they're competing, because they've built this gap to the midfield cars. And therefore, later on in the race, if they're, say, for example, second, they can convert to a two-stop to try and challenge it. Worst comes off, if it doesn't work, they still finish second. If it does work, they overtake and finish first. It's great. It's. I remember being experienced all levels of it. So being at the top, being in the midfield, and being at the bottom. The top is the easiest place to do strategy. I mean, there's obviously a lot more to lose in it. Yeah. So if you make a call, you're high profile, you lose a lot of points, you lose the race win, everyone focuses on it. But in terms of making calls, you just have generally that bit more freedom and flexibility and time to do it.
So like with ours, it's sort of the circumstance decides it for you if you're at the back of the midfield, say?
Sometimes. So yeah, I was going to answer that. So your midfield, obviously, if you're competing with 3 or 4 different teams, you don't have these kind of gaps to drop into. You have to be a bit more reactive, looking at the teams around you, trying to judge your pace, trying to judge your tyre degradation. And this is where your flexibility comes in. But you go into a race trying to best plan it as much as you can. And you also then, the next stage of it is, right, what are the likely scenarios that are going to happen in this race? And you rank them. Because obviously, there could be millions of permutations of what happens. You don't never know when exactly there's a safety car going to be. You don't know the exact pace everyone's going to be. You have a good idea and you have a good model of it, but you can never be spot on at any point of what's going to happen in this race. So you just need to kind of focus and get these likelihoods of which strategy is the best one or most likely. What's the likelihood of this happening? If this happens, what's this car going to likely do, etc.
It's like just chess.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, it's fully about that. And then every lap of the race that goes on, you monitor the situation and go, right, how is it enveloping? And it's like, have they got a gap to drop into? Am I at threat from an undercut this lap? I've got 3 cars behind me and I'm held up by the car in front, right? What's best to do in this situation? And each lap, you just review it. And that's why the midfields, there's just so much more going on. So you just have to kind of try and figure out what's likely to happen. And like you say, like it's chess, it's trying to make that move before someone else does and put you into that situation.
I've got a question. How much can the drivers influence you? Because a lot of the time they're stuck behind someone at a track they can't overtake and they're like, they're 2 laps into a stint and they're like, get me out of this guy, you know, or they want new fresh boots. And you're like, if you pit now, we literally can't do anything, mate.
Yeah, basically. I mean, so it's the... The thing with, like, we have our strategy meetings, or I used to have these strategy meetings, but every team has these strategy meetings on a Sunday morning. And if you're doing your job well as a strategist, you will have painted the picture to the driver of what needs to be required, what needs to happen, what lap you kind of need to get to, what the window is. So if they're coming on shouting something which you haven't discussed or you've already explained to them, but no, this isn't the case. You just got to ignore it. Sometimes there is situations where something happen and they're explaining, but the tyres are struggling a lot more than you were expecting or foresighting. But then you try and tighten with the data and you go, do I see this? And then again, it's that, right, okay, I go on to my plan B on this one. How does that look going on to it. No, it still doesn't look any better than just trying to play this out. And sometimes it comes off, sometimes it doesn't. Like, you can try and hold on to something and it'll be a scenario where, no, you just fall off. And then that's when you hear the driver comes on going, I told you we should have done this. And you just go, yes, fantastic. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
But look, I'm the one with the slide rule, Kevin. Yeah. Look, speaking of like rolling the dice and having that kind of strategy where, you know, what I call like the Jenson Button strategy. He got a reputation in changeable conditions because he'd just go, I'll just do a different whatever. If it doesn't work, no one will remember. If it works, I'm a genius. I wonder if you've got more freedom to do that in the midfield. I think Mercedes seemed to go through a period, like 2020, 2019, 2018, where, like you're saying, the pressure to make decisions is much higher, even though you've got more flexibility. They seem to be very reactive. Like, they never rolled the dice, and it was almost like they were trapped by their own positions and success.
Yeah, that's, I mean, 100%. So, I mean, you talked about Jensen, and Kevin actually is another one who's exactly like this. He's very willing to...
Let's give it a pun.
...do something, which is, he'll take those drives a lap earlier than everyone else, even if it's, you're looking and going, really? But he's very much of that opinion. He'd, if he's running, say, P13, P14, he'd much rather take a gamble and it come off and finish P7, P8, P6, something like that. Mm. And if it doesn't come off, finish P20, then finish P13. Like, it, when you're in those lower midfield towards the back, you need to do something that little bit different to get up the field. If you do the same as everyone else, you're just going to finish where you are. So you need to do it. So, and it, that ties in with the Mercedes one, where that risk, the risk reward is just too much for them to take that gamble. And it's the same. So, like, if they're P1, you won't take that risk. Whereas someone in P2 goes, well,
why not?
I can take a risk because worst comes to worst, so like, I'll finish P2. And like, but if it comes off, I will beat this car in P1. And so I can very much understand why they take that approach. And yeah, it makes perfect sense from a strategic point of view.
From the sofa, it can sometimes look a little bit negative and a little bit like, yeah, it can feel like a do-nothing approach, but it's not.
It's not, no, it's very calculated. I mean, touch on the race we don't talk about at the end of last year, and it's like, why didn't he pit another safety car? Well, because he would have put himself in P2 on a race which was, in, if you're looking at percentages, was 98% likely to finish under the safety car. So everyone would have screamed, why have they chucked away the race win? And he's finished P2 in the championship, et cetera, et cetera. We all know what happened. And yeah.
But I'm not allowed to talk about it anymore, Mike, or the YouTube comments go off at me. But yeah. Let's get away from Abu Dhabi 21. I'm starting to think they're not going to avoid lap 58, you know, Mike? That's what I'm starting to think. So this season, you're going to be consulting, say no more, nudge and a wink, and watching it, you know, like we are. And you listened, I know you listened to the odd podcast on occasion. What do you think, you know, idiots like me who, and Matt, who try to get down to the heart of the strategy, you know, firstly, like, how often do you just bang your head against the desk going, you morons? But like, what is it that we're kind of missing that would enable us to be better strategy analysts?
It's like, right, for a start, I never say that about you guys. Just in general. It's
for
like,
F1's people, sake, though, idiots. Yeah.
But people try and like, and I mean, strategy, we have a term as like an F1 strategist, and it's a real go. It's like, you see Twitter comments about it, you try and avoid it. Like, I saw them plenty of times about, well, not about me personally, because they maybe didn't see it, but like about the past strategists or about the Mercedes strategist, etc.
Are you not tempted? I bet you've got a sock account, like Kike Moorfield. And
but yeah, we refer to these basically as Monday morning strategists.
Yes.
So like, they kind of jump on, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but clearly should have done this, etc. But it's understandable why people do this.
It's fan crack, isn't it? You know.
Well, yeah. But and also during the race, they don't have the information which we do. So like, we have literally everything. So we have sector times, we have GPS, we have mini sectors, we have like lots of visualizations where you see in the pace of a car, how it projects it for like 3-4 laps time, tire degradation, everything coming in like this. So you can map it out of how it's going to go. And while trying to give it to the general public is maybe giving all this information would just be too much, because again, I'm not trying to because I don't want to discredit strategies, but like I've been doing it one way or another for close to 16 years, and it takes you a good 4, 5, 6 years to kind of at least get the understanding of the situational awareness of a race strategy.
And it all happens so fast as well when you need to make that call.
Well, then that's it. And it's like what we talked about earlier. It's all about this kind of chess game. So you're trying to pick up things which haven't happened, and you're trying to predict what's going to happen, and you're trying to like form that picture in your mind. You're trying to think 4, 5, 6 moves ahead to see where, at what point you have to react and do it. And this is where the awareness, and this is what makes you good strategists, and you want guys who are sat on the pit wall they won't have just turned up at university and rocked up one day and sat on the pit wall and gone, all right, I've nailed it. I mean, like I said, I've been doing it 16 years, and even last year when I was doing it, you're still sitting there going, oh, I made a mistake there. It's like, and you do, because it's every, you've got 9 other people up against you trying to outfox you to an extent.
If my little tree face, my little 11-year-old, he watches this interview and goes, I want to be just like Mike. What does he have to do? What path do you go down to be an F1 strategist? General engineering first?
Yeah, so I mean, that's what I did. I mean, I did, normal maths, physics, good at numbers. Like, in terms of personal skills, which obviously you can't learn. Well, you can learn, but like just having a logical mind, obviously, is that kind of any aspect. So you're doing your things like you're playing chess, doing your Sudokus, all that kind of stuff. All that kind of focuses your mind in that kind of behavioural stuff. Then the next bit of it, and of a strategist, you go into university. I did aero engineering. You can do mechanical engineering, auto engineering, and anything those long lines. But getting into it is like, I mean, like F1, like anything is just getting your foot in the door and just being trying to get in as a junior or a graduate strategist. And then that's where the fun learns. And that's when you realize I've learned nothing in these past 4 years at university. Now this is where the learning curve happens, where you see it all. And that learning curve, when you first come in, is steep.
So lots of making cup of tea to start with and sweeping up the hangar.
Pretty much. Yeah. Going outside to get wind samples and out in the plastic bag. Yeah. All that kind of stuff. But it's just getting your head involved and just getting involvement really, and just understanding the bits and pieces. And then the next bit about being a strategist is that you need to have good personal skills as well. And some people don't, and some people do, but you obviously have to try and sell your strategy to a race driver or your chief race engineer or your race engineer, for example. You can have all the points, but if you're not convincing, or like if you sound less than convincing when you do it, they'll have a doubt in your mind. And then that's when you get the feedback on the radio, because you haven't sold like the strategy well enough. You haven't given the enough information. So again, it all comes with experience, and it all comes with how you learn it.
Let me be nosy, and I'm not trying to be all gossipy, Mike, so you don't have to name names here, but does your strategy change a lot depending on which driver is in the car, or are the drivers ballast?
No, I mean, I've always tried to be, when I've done it, I've always tried to be fair.
Yeah. I was thinking more of their skill sets. Like, you know, if you've got a Perez who's a tyre whisperer, might you change your tactics?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely aspects where your Perez is like, he can do some things that others can't. And then you will take that into account. You will potentially look at it. I mean, I won't say unfortunately, but the guys I've kind of worked with in the past have never really pushed it into that kind of.
Right.
They've never been these outstanding tyre managements to be fair. So I've never really had that kind of the skill set to work with, but because they are few and far between. I think Perez is one of them. Obviously, he's very good with tyre management. Gasly's another one. He's
really
Gasly. I mean, you always find that Gasly. Well, front tyre management. So if you ever get any races which are front graining, Gasly is a very good driver to drive through it.
That's interesting. So, but he's not as kind to the rears.
Potentially not. No, okay. I think he can lean on the fronts and not damage them a bit more than the rears. Yeah, but yeah, those front ones. So your races like your Monaco and stuff, at Gasly's and Abu Dhabi, Gasly's a very strong driver.
Okay, and could that be why? I mean, Hamilton seems to go missing at Monaco in that example that you gave. He seems to never quite spark there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. It could just be psychological over Lewis. I mean, Lewis, again, he's a very good, very good driver. That's what
he's quite good, isn't he? He's all right, yeah.
He's quite good. He's all right. And you don't get to where he is without being able to manage the tyres and manage it relative to each other. So I think it'd be harsh to say that he struggles on Monaco because of that. I think I don't know.
People just have favourite tracks, don't they, I suppose?
Yeah, that's it. Sometimes it's just they are unusual, and you get people who can just turn it on at your places like Monaco, where it's obviously millimetres becomes between your pole position and not having a suspension left on your car.
You know karting, Mike. You always get a local track bandit, don't you? Yeah. That's what happens there. So as viewers, me and Matt have, since the F1 live timing, I think, has improved, and watching sector times during the race, that's just invigorated our viewing of Formula One, because even when it seems like nothing's happening, you can look at lap times and you can kind of spot when they're saving or when they're pushing, but that push starts to bleed away because they've used the new tyres. So at that level, I mean, even me and Matt can just about keep track of that. Is there anything else that we could see if the FIA chose to show it to us that could make us better, what do we call it, Monday morning strategists?
Monday morning strategists.
What would make us better?
Well, you wouldn't be a Monday morning strategist if you had this information live. I think the one thing which I think is missing most is just this kind of, it's the interactions around pit stops. So it's just seeing, they put the track map on occasionally and then the track map disappears off and you're kind of thinking, hang on a minute, I want to see where he's dropping out. I want to see what the group of cars is around there. Like, it's just getting that idea about when cars can pit. So you've maybe given an idea of putting a visual of a pit window on the screen, so you see where the cars are, so they kind of line up. And you can see if he pits out now, he's going to come out just behind this group of six cars. So it gives an information.
Yes, that would be good to see, wouldn't it?
And or vice versa, the car pits, and then you see him coming into the pit window, so you can see maybe when someone's going to react. Or put it on a track map. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of how you kind of, you focus it on the screen, but there is definitely ways of trying to show that interaction of who has pitted, where they're lining up, what the gaps are, like, other than what's being shown on the TV at that point. And actually, sometimes it's just even basic things like the F1 graphics on the side of the screen. I mean, they sometimes change it to just like highlighting where they kind of, what the pit window is when you highlight on a certain car. So they'll show gaps between certain cars, but you don't know, like, you'll get the crofty occasionally saying, oh yeah, it's a 20-second pit stop loss around here. And you're kind of like, okay, but this is a cumulative time. So I'm having to do all these calculations in my head going, okay, right, so that works out in that point there. That's
maths on the spot. Yeah, I'm out. I don't want to be an F1 strategist, Mike. I don't want to do it. After the race, obviously if the driver has gone to glory, if a midfield team, he's rolled the dice and he's got sixth place, which for me, sixth place still feels special because I'm old enough to remember when it's only 6 points. Yeah, even in betting odds, they still give top six. But the driver will take the credit for that. And if it goes wrong, I'm sure you get the blame. So like, how does that work after the race?
Oh, yeah. You never, like, I mean, the strategist, it's a thankless job. It really is. It's like, it's because... I reference it to like being an airline pilot, you know. So guys
people only hear about it if it's good.
Oh yeah, you did your job. You got us a good strategy. Yeah, fantastic. It's like you crashed the plane. No, so it's gone wrong.
I feel like the pit stop crew guys are like that as well. Like they're in a bit of a thankless position as well.
Oh, massively. No, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's like those guys. Because I did a lot of work with the kind of pit stop stuff at both Mercedes and Haas, just trying to just go through them. And yeah, it's totally thankless for them. They're they're criticised for doing a 2.8 instead of a 2.2. And it's horrible, isn't it?
What were you trying to do with them? Were you trying to bring the times down, or were you talking through strategies with them? Or
no, so we're purely on the pit stop stuff. So it's the whole kind of, I mean, obviously pit stops play a big part in terms of strategy. We obviously want the pit stops as quick as possible, but you've got to put that balance in, and then it's just training. So it's actually moves away from the everyday strategy, but it's the kind of training them up, looking at your techniques, doing your video analysis, looking at your times, like in each breaking down each part of the in each part of the pit stop. So your wheel on, your wheel off, your gun times, your connection times, front and rear jacks. So it's that other part of strategy. I enjoyed it because I liked working directly with the crews, and it's kind of like a sport. Well, it's a sports team within a sports team as such. So you're trying to G them up and get them going. I mean, and like when you passed last year, when you're running around the bottom and you're trying to have something to fight for and just give them something to aim for. It's sometimes it's just that little thing which you can do. But yeah, it's pit stops are, I mean, the major. And I mean, they've come on so far in the last 6 years or so. It's just...
Do they like incredible. It? Do they like the fact that they can make or break a race? Or are they like, I wish we just had mandatory 20-second stops. That would be good.
I don't know. I've never... I think some do, some don't. I mean, and because it has to be your mechanics, because you're limited on the amount of personnel you can,
it's not their only job, yeah.
It's not like NASCAR, who literally have teams to do the pit stops, and that's it. It's not their only job. So I think a lot of them kind of would probably prefer not to do it.
Live without it.
And some do it reluctantly, some will do it and enjoy it and look to kind of get the most out of it and take pleasure on it. But it's, again, it's very much a personality thing in that respect. I think it's obviously not the main job. And I think, some take the challenge, some don't. But unfortunately, it's trying to manage that situation and put the best people in the best places and trying to encourage them and or incentivize them, etc.
I like the idea of you sitting there late at night before a Grand Prix going, Derek's not been great on bottom left, you know, we'll have to put Izzy on rear left next time, and we'll try that, you know, really like doing there should be a computer game, Pit Stop Tire Manager. That would be fun. Before I let you go, because what time is it in Bahrain now? It's getting towards evening time, I think, isn't it? Getting towards the Sherry zone there, Mike. So I'll just ask you one last thing. I'm going to put you in charge of the FIA rules, and we're going to concentrate on rules that involve strategy. So do you want to create rules that bring more strategy into it, or rules that would take strategy out of the way and leave it to the engineers and the drivers? You know, how much should Mike Caulfield's play a difference in the result?
I think strategy definitely plays a part. I think it's part of F1, which is, I think, needed. I think it's something which, when you watch like Formula E, and they don't have pit stops and they don't have the tyre stuff. All right, they have the bit where they go through the whatever it's called, driver boost or that
electro shock zone. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. To try and like, but for me, it kind of, I don't know. It just takes something away from it. But I think it needs the balance. And I actually think F1's got it quite good at the moment, because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier and about that kind of visualization and trying to view the race as a viewer. And if you start getting like 2-3 stops, like as your normal, you soon start becoming a bit lost of what's actually going on.
We saw it, didn't we? We did have a period of that.
You sit there and like I used to get messages from my dad going, I have no idea what's going on.
What's happening?
It's kind of like, because you're like, you don't know who'd stopped, you don't know if he's got another stop to make, and it starts. Whereas in the recent years, I kind of think the 1v2 stop kind of races have been really exciting. There's that potential. It's you've got some overtaking on track, you've got that build up to the finale where someone's converted to a 2-stop and someone's remained on a 1-stop, and it's that kind of, is he going to catch him? Is he going to overtake him? Is he going to hold him off? And I think that's what you need. And you do have that variance, and obviously it very much depends on the tyres and the track characteristics. But I think if you start pushing it too further away from that, it starts coming a bit too chaotic. And while strategy plays a bit part, I think it starts losing a bit of the actual kind of driver skill and the kind of, because I know people complaining, oh, I don't want to see drivers managing the tyres, but actually it can be a good thing. It adds that extra variable. Why shouldn't a driver be rewarded who can manage the tyres a little bit better than someone else? If they're all driving flat out for 60 laps of the race, and if they're all driving flat out, you won't have seen much overtaking because they'll just be everyone kind of full blown, can go into corners, can tap brake in, don't leave any gaps. It'll be a bit chaotic, but I don't think it'll actually result in good racing. Whereas you've got someone trying to eke out a one stop and he's managing tyres, and he gets the end of the race and he's held off and he's won, he's rewarded for it. So it's both a reward of strategy and a reward of the driving because he's managed to do something on it. So
I do feel like if more the people who were complaining like about the France Grand Prix 3 years ago when nothing happened, if they had more of an insight into the strategy, and in fact, I think it might have been the Austin Grand Prix this year, where on the surface there was people complaining it was boring, but it was actually quite a fascinating race, but you needed the information and like five different screens to be able to follow it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the France one for about 3 years ago, that was boring. And
extreme.
There was six overtakes in the whole race or something, and it was a one-stop. So it wasn't, But I think this year, kind of, France pushed it, didn't it? Where, Verstappen two stops against Lewis's one-stop and caught at the end and overtook. And it was, it's that kind of, it was a bold move because going into the race, it's a very much a one-stop. And the tyres can do it quite easily, but he did that kind of slight adjustment where I'll push the tyres that little bit more and have to make up this pit stop and come through a bit more traffic. And it adds that variance, but it doesn't add that too much variance where it becomes that chaotic kind of cluster of what's going on. I just don't know. And then even as a strategist, you sat there going, what's going on?
It's too much. If even your dad, who I'm assuming is a good armchair strategist normally, can't follow it, Mike, then maybe it's too much. Go and follow Mike, though, at Mike Caulfield F1. So it's Mike, CAULFIELD, F1 on Twitter. And I will harass you to come back again, Mike, and help us become better Monday morning strategists.
Yeah, definitely. I'm happy to help out where I can. And I think this weekend could be quite interesting.
Oh, well, maybe we'll try and get you a hot take after the first few races. Please follow Missed Apex at Missed Apex F1. We've got our Facebook page as well. We're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Spanners Ready. And you can be a patron at patreon.com/Missed Apex. Join us at 8 p.m. live for our Bahrain race review. Many thanks to Mike. Join us to get our hot impressions straight off the press, and maybe we'll have a live picture-in-picture. We'll have Mike in the corner either shaking his head or giving us a thumbs up for our analysis, although I'm quite nervous now in the context that we're going to be accused of being armchair strategists. Until we see you again, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals.
So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.